All right, everybody, you're listening to the soothing sounds of Frédéric Chopin's Nocturne Number 2. Welcome back to the Invisible College. I'm your host, John Pastelli. This is my series of literature courses for paid subscribers to grandhotelabyss.substack.com. We are well embarked now on a study of the modern British literature from on the modern British, that's sort of a non-native speaker locution, no offense to anyone, on modern British literature from Romanticism to Modernism. We are approaching the end of our discussion of the Romantic period. We are into the second generation. We looked at Percy Bysshe Shelley last week, and this week we are going to look at John Keats, two figures often considered together. And I'll begin by asking why they're often considered together. I chose Chopin for my audio introduction because Keats and Chopin, I think, are often grouped together, as well as Chopin and Van Gogh, because the YouTube video I have of Chopin's Nocturne is Van Gogh's Starry Night. And what do these three figures have in common? The musician, the painter, the poet, all of them were taken from us too soon, all of them associated with a kind of a lyricism, a devotion to beauty that seemed too pure for the world. And so there is this kind of, you know, this association, this three-way association. There's been a book about Keats and Chopin I saw just Googling it. I've never read it. I don't actually know anything about music. But leaving Van Gogh aside, Keats and Chopin both died young, both had this impossible yearning for a romantic partnership they could never fully consummate, and they're both associated with a kind of perfect lyricism in their art. So that's why I began with Chopin to discuss John Keats. This lecture on John Keats will be called The Realms of Gold, and you'll see why in a moment. There will be a slideshow to go with the lecture. You will find that in PDF form at grandhotelabyss.substack.com. Thanks again for joining me. So let's start talking about John Keats, perhaps my own. Well, I don't know if he's my own favorite. Of the big six romantics, you'll see next week. I need to really reacquaint myself with Byron. I've never gone deeply into Byron. I've always been a little bit indifferent to Byron, and have mostly, I've not read his epics. Well, maybe I'll read them by the next time we talk, or at least I'll sort of immerse myself and see what happens. I am quite familiar with Manfred, which is what we're going to talk about with Byron next week, but I'm pretty indifferent to Byron. I tolerate Wordsworth, though I find him kind of depressing in his somnolence and his humorlessness and his prosiness and his moralism. Coleridge, you know, he has those three perfect dream visions: the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Christabel, and Kubla Khan. But and those, well, you know, one loves, one admires, but there's not much else there. So really the three that interest me are Blake, Shelley, and Keats, except I don't fully understand Blake, and I don't fully approve of Shelley. And so I'm kind of left with Keats as my favorite. And I think Keats in certain ways is the person among the six romantic poets who kind of is the progenitor of the tradition coming out of the romantic poets that I like, that leads into Oscar Wilde and James Joyce and subsequent, you know, writers. Though William Blake, in a way, leads on to James Joyce as well. And I love Shelley because I think Shelley leads on to Virginia Woolf. So, but those are, I like Blake, Shelley, Keats, Wordsworth, Byron, Coleridge. I like those three. So those are my preferences among the big six. So we're talking about Keats. Now, why is Keats often grouped with Shelley? as you'll see, they didn't know each other that well. I think I even mentioned that they didn't know each other that well in the lecture on Shelley. They were sort of just distantly acquainted. Part of the reason is, of course, that Shelley wrote that elegy for Keats, Adonais, that we looked at last week. And so he kind of permanently linked his name to Keats and therefore Keats's name to his. They're really quite different. And the place I'm probably going to end this lecture is in a letter Keats writes to Shelley that I forgot to put on the syllabus. I knew it existed and I had read it in the Norton Anthology, and it has one of Keats's most famous lines in it. And I was aware of it, but I just forgot, or I didn't look carefully enough, or whatever. And I was reminded forcefully that it existed and that it was important because one of you out there, my kind listeners, sent me actually a thesis that you had written on Keats that discusses this letter, and also discusses the fall of Hyperion, which I also revisited for the sake of this. And so I want to thank you for that thesis that is inspired because I'm revisiting Keats in full for the first time in a while. So it's probably inspired some of what I'm going to say here. So you know who you are for sending me the thesis. Thank you very much. So we'll look at Keats's reply to a letter he had received from Shelley that enumerates a certain difference between them in their attitudes toward poetry and what poetry should be and its relation to the ethical, the moral, the political. But still, they're grouped together. They're one of the peer-reviewed journals in the field of romantic studies is called the Keats-Shelley Journal. Another one of you, kind listeners, asked me to pick up the Camille Paglia thread. I had sort of dropped her. I was using her as a guide for the first three, and then I forgot to come back to her with Shelley because Shelley is such a difficult poet in his way. That I just got caught up in just explicating kind of the surface level of his work. But I did forget to mention Paglia, so I'll go back to her. I'm not going to use her for every writer we look at. Well, she doesn't have anything useful to say about certain. She has nothing useful to say about realism. She has nothing useful to say about modernism. So it's mainly only the writers in the kind of visionary romantic aestheticist tradition that will that I'll go back to her. So when we look at Oscar Wilde, for instance, I'll go back to her. But she does talk about all six romantics, but her chapter on, she has a chapter freestanding on Blake, freestanding on Wordsworth, freestanding on Coleridge, freestanding on Byron, but Keats and Shelley are a pair. She has a single chapter on Keats and Shelley. So why are they associated? I think that there is that connection through the elegy. I think that there is the fact that they both died young and that they both typify that aspect of the romantic character. Byron died young too, but in a very different circumstance. They died young of disease, and not just any disease, but a disease that had a kind of metaphorical association with being too pure for the world. That was Keats. And then Shelley, kind of drowned after writing poem after poem about the poet being in this wandering bark out at sea. And so they both seem to be like reabsorbed into this spiritual realm from which they came to us. So there's that kind of poetic association. And I think the other thing, and we're going to look at this aspect. I didn't stress this aspect of Shelley. I am going to stress it a little more of Keats. Is the idea of classicism. Not classism, though we'll have to talk about. I mean, I think classism is a stupid word, actually, if we're going to get political. But so that would be the prejudice on the basis of class, which is something John Keats faced, as I'll discuss. But what I mean is classicism, an interest in the study in, particularly in this case, Greek antiquity. We saw that Blake was quite hostile to Greek antiquity. He said Greek form is mathematic form, Gothic form is living form. So he had that medievalizing let's go back to the roots of our Northern European patrimony, and let's ignore these Greeks. And he says in the preface to Milton, the perverted writings of Plato and Cicero, I don't remember who he named exactly, but the perverted writings of these Greek and Roman writers are responsible for the wars of Europe, etc. So he wasn't interested in the Greeks. Wordsworth, too, and Coleridge, too, were both interested, again, like Blake, in that medieval ballad tradition. Let's go back to medieval England or medieval Northern Europe and recover that sense of our lost heritage. And when this view is developed further, particularly in Germany, which had a similar romantic attitude, it's often the contrast between the Gothic and the Northern and the Southern, the Greek, the Roman Empire, or sometimes the French, the Italians, the Greeks. They're this empire that has tried to conquer the northern tribes, whether that be in England or in Germany. So we need to get back to that sense of the north. You don't get that in Keats and Shelley. Keats and Shelley had this interest in reviving particularly Greece. So Shelley's big poem, his biggest poem, is Prometheus Unbound, his revision, his progressive revision of Aeschylus's tragedy, Prometheus Bound. So he's always looking back to that Greek heritage, not to mention that he's traveling in Italy. He spends an enormous amount of time in Italy. Same with Byron. Byron would eventually die in Greece. What are these people's interest in Italy and Greece? Part of it, and this would be true of some American romantic writers too, particularly Margaret Fuller, who dies, spoiler warning for the Margaret Fuller lecture that will occur months and months from now, but she dies coming